And now,
great to be back.
Back to the Bill Frank Radio Show.
Awesome.
And your host, Bill Frank.
My next guest is an outspoken critic of pseudoscientists who assert that humanity blights the planet. We'll discuss his repudiation titled The Merchants of Despair. Robert Zubrin is a New Atlantis contributing editor, a fellow at the Center for Security Policy, and the president of Pioneer Astronautics, an aerospace engineering R&D firm. He holds a doctorate in nuclear engineering and has 9 U.S. patents granted or pending. Robert is the author of 4 nonfiction books. He's appeared on major media, including CNN, C-SPAN, BBC, the Discovery Channel, the Science Channel, NBC, ABC, and NPR. Robert's latest book is titled Merchants of Despair, Radical Environmentalists, Criminal Pseudoscientists, and the Fatal Cult of Anti-Humanism, and it traces the pedigree of the ideology that human beings are a cancer upon the earth and provides scientific refutation to anti-humanist major pseudoscientific claims. Joining us from the greater Denver area, how are you today, Robert?
I'm fine. Thanks for inviting me on your show.
Well, thank you so much for being our special guest. I guess the first place to start is with the title of your book, because you write about the cult of anti-humanism. So let's start there. What is anti-humanism?
Basically, anti-humanism is the belief that humans are destroyers rather than creators. And so their numbers, activities, and liberties must be severely constrained, and some authority must be empowered to do the constraining. It's essentially a justification for tyranny, and that is why it has always had sponsors.
All right, and I want to come back and explore that in some greater detail, but I first want to start with something that's relatively breaking news, and that's just recently, a couple of months ago, the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, that's NASA for short, they spoke out in favor of global warming. And then just shortly thereafter, several about 50 astronauts denounced NASA's climate's conclusions. So as an aerospace engineer, you must have been pretty pleased by that. But I guess my first question is, even within one branch of the government, how can there be such disagreement among experts?
Well, the reason why all the veterans at NASA spoke out against this campaign was because they recognized it for what it was, which was political climatology. Look, in the 1970s, there was a cooling trend going on, and so the anti-humans all said, look, there's global cooling, it's being driven by industry, which is being driven by out-of-control population growth and economic growth, they got to be put under control, put us in control. Then in the 80s, the climate trend turned around and started to warm, and they said, look, there's global warming, it's being driven by out-of-control economic growth and population growth, they're out of control, they got to be put under control, put us in control. The problem is always different, the solution is always the same, and I mean, the issue with the global warming is particularly ridiculous because while there may well be warming and there may well be cooling because the climate is always changing, in general, the warming trends are better for humans and for nature. They lengthen the growing season and they increase net rainfall. And yet here we have a campaign going on to punish humanity for a warming trend, which is either natural or, if it is created by humans, it's something good that humans are doing for the biosphere.
All right, well, let's take a look at some of those natural phenomena that you just discussed a moment ago. Talking about CO2 levels in the air is a good thing for us, and it increases the worldwide rainfall, which is interesting, and lengthens growing season. So if that is the case, then how do you explain the recent drought in the Midwest, which is killing both wheat and corn crops and will eventually drive up our food prices here in the United States?
Well, there's constant climate changes. There's constant local climate changes, and there can be local droughts. There can be, but if you look at human history, what you see as a whole is that the warming trends have been better. Warming, by definition, increases the total amount of water that's evaporated out of the ocean, and that stuff all comes down somewhere. The CO2 absolutely accelerates plant growth. We have photographs taken from orbit since 1958, and they show that the rate of plant growth around the world, and I'm not just talking about agricultural plants, including wild plants here, forests, jungles, grasslands, has accelerated by 14%. And we know that's due to the increase of CO2 in the atmosphere because you can repeat the experiment in the lab and you'll get the exact same result for entirely understandable reasons that CO2 is plant food. And so literally 1 out of every 7 organisms on the face of the planet right now owes its existence to human CO2 emissions. So here we are, we're making the Earth a more fertile planet, but the anti-humans, who are basically prosecutors looking for some grounds to put humanity in shackles, they find this to be criminal and grounds to, well, put humanity in shackles.
All right. My guest is Robert Zubin, author of the book Merchants of Despair. Robert, what about some other observable phenomena, things like the glaciers melting and the Sahara Desert expanding?
Well, the Sahara Desert actually started expanding with the fall of the Roman Empire, which occurred during a period of global cooling we call the Dark Ages. And but look, I'm not denying to you that there's global warming. I think there very well may be global warming. I think there is a slight warming trend going on right now, and I think it's a very positive thing for the biosphere as a whole, especially if it's being driven by CO2 emissions, and the CO2 levels are increasing. What I'm pointing out to you is the issue here is not about weather. It's about liberty.
All right. I don't want to come back to that. So they've touched on so many different things here. Let's come back to the 1970s for just a minute, because I remember the period where scientists were worried about the global cooling and the next ice age. We might be entering into a mini ice age. Historically, the 1970s were kind of a low point for scientists in many ways. I mean, not only did we have their misprediction about global cooling, which then flipped and became global warming, but we also had the Club of Rome in 1972, which was out there saying that we were going to run out of resources, oil and things like that, by 1990. And now with hindsight, we can see that that just wasn't the case. So I guess my question for you is, how do these forces just flip on a dime, go from global cooling to global warming, in order to marshal this entrapment that you're talking about?
Because the issue is never the issue, okay? In other words, you have the Club of Rome saying we're going to run out of everything, and so we need to stop economic growth, and basically the world needs to be put under rationing, okay? And that is the bottom line. You know, I got into this years ago, back in the 70s. I became a nuclear engineer, and, you know, you have the anti-human saying, look, we have to stop economic growth because we're running out of oil, and it's smoking up the atmosphere. Then you say, well, look, we got nuclear power. We're never going to run out, and it doesn't produce any smoke. They say, we don't want that. And many people in the nuclear industry were completely puzzled by the opposition of these alleged environmentalists to nuclear power because it has the least environmental impact of any energy-producing technology. And the reason for the hysterical opposition, though, is very simply this. It solves a problem that they want to have. They want to have a problem of resource shortages that would put them in the position of those who do the rationing. And if someone comes along and says there's no need for rationing, they say, I don't want to hear it. Shut up. You know, they say there's famine. We have to stop population growth. We must have population control top down, like in China. And someone comes along and says, well, we got these new crops here. They got triple the yield. They got much more vitamins in them than the traditional crops. They say, we don't want that. Stop it. Stop it with this green revolution. Stop it with your genetically modified crops that contain vitamin A. We don't want that. Okay? And whatever it is, they don't want the solution. They want the problem. I mean, remember Ron Emanuel, President Obama's political advisor, he says, never let a crisis go to waste.
Yes.
Well, never let the opportunity to create a crisis go to waste if you're in the position of someone who wants to engage in crisis management of people.
All right. My guest is Robert Zubin, off of the book Merchants of Despair. So, Robert, I'm going to challenge you here then. Within the constructs of your theory, how does the Obama administration's failed attempt at cap and trade fit in? I mean, if the anti-humanists are so powerful and persuasive, why did cap and trade fail?
I'm not alleging they're omnipotent. I'm alleging they are powerful. The reason why it failed, frankly, is because the policy is so bad politically that in a country that still has a certain amount of democracy in it, enough Democratic congressmen did not want to put their name on a bill that would destroy the jobs of their constituents. That's why cap and trade failed. And so they have gone around the Congress and have the EPA doing this in an unconstitutional fashion. In other words, they're having the bureaucracy make law instead of Congress because the democratically elected Congress won't go for these anti-human policies.
All right, my guest is Robert Zubin. So, Robert, it begs the bigger question. How do these anti-humanists attract powerful people to their cause, people like politicians, like celebrities, like the media?
Well, there's a couple of reasons. One is that the policy, the ideology that the anti-humanists are spreading justifies the enhancement of power of elites. And it justifies their role as rulers, because if you have a situation, for instance, you take the situation you just named, where the people's representatives won't vote to impose the rationing of fire, well, then they simply must take a hand themselves. So now it's a justification for a seizure of power against democratic institutions. you know, it also elevates their own conception of themselves. Let me read you a quote from a book written by John Holdren, who is President Obama's science advisor, and Paul Ehrlich, who is his mentor and who wrote the earlier book, The Population Bomb. Okay, here's what they say. It says, when a population of organism grows in a finite environment, sooner or later it will encounter a resource limit. This phenomenon, described by ecologists as reaching the carrying capacity of the environment, applies to bacteria on a culture dish, to fruit flies in a jar of agar, and to buffalo on a prairie. It must also apply to man on this finite planet. So there you have it. They see humanity as a bunch of fruit flies in a jar of agar whose must be governed and limited and culled by the wise scientists who stand above them like gods running the lab. And that is their self-conception.
All right. Now, my guest is Robert Zubrin. So, Robert, all of that, whether you're talking about Ehrlich or whether you're talking about Holdren's philosophy, it all goes back to Thomas Malthus and the Malthusian idea. I think it was from the 1800s, if I'm not mistaken. How can that perpetuate itself? I mean, we're in the 21st century now. How does that perpetuate itself for over 200 years?
Because it is convenient, okay? Just as Malthus's theory, saying the poor must always starve, was convenient for justifying the oppressive policy of his employer, the British East India Company, and of their peers who were exploiting Ireland in similar fashion and causing millions of people to starve, this starvation, this is not being caused by oppression. This is simply a law of nature. Adolf Hitler, 1941, gave a speech in which he said, the laws of existence prescribe unlimited killing so that the better might live. In other words, according to Hitler, it's not his hate that is driving genocide. It is simply the inconvenient truth that there isn't enough to go around, and so some people have to be exterminated. And so people like him aren't necessary. Okay? And so people who wish to justify oppressive policies promote such ideologies.
All right. Well, then it begs the bigger question, though, Robert. How do the anti-humanists marginalize dissenters so effectively?
Well, because they have at their disposal the organs of power. I mean, you take, for example, this absurd Club of Rome report that came out in 1972, in which they said that we're going to run out of everything by 1990. This was acclaimed in the New York Times. This was acclaimed in the Washington Post. It was acclaimed by all the mainstream media. And anybody who opposed it was basically dismissed as, you know, some Neanderthal from the Chamber of Commerce, these people who can't face the facts that economic growth is impossible because there's only so much resources in the world and we've used it up, okay? And so, you know, and they're just portrayed as deniers when, in fact, the people who are deniers are the anti-humans who are constantly in denial of the effects of their policies. You know, in other words, what is the result of a policy of rigging up energy prices by preventing us from drilling? Okay, well, it's economic disaster for the U.S. and it's starvation in the third world. Okay, what is the consequence of preventing us from using valuable new technologies, nuclear power, genetically improved foods, pesticides? It's all extremely harmful to humanity, and they just choose to look the other way. Okay, they are deniers of a Holocaust that they have been creating.
My guest is Robert Zubrin, author of the book Merchants of Despair. So, Robert, as a humanist, you believe that humanity is a species of creators. You've said that already. Anti-humanist believes that humanity destroys. Let me put it another way. Anti-humanists believe that science and progress destroy our planet. You believe that science will solve our problems. So what proof do you have that science will actually help us in overcoming our problems? And then, more importantly, what makes your belief in science that much better or more valid than an anti-humanist belief that science is destructive?
Well, because if you look at human history, you can look at the fact that as human numbers and knowledge have increased, human well-being has increased. We live much better today than people lived in 1930s when Paul Ehrlich was born and the world population was one-third of what it is today and our science was more backward. And people in the 1930s lived much better than they were in Malthus's time in 1800, which were in turn people lived much better than they did at the time of the Roman Empire. The theory that human well-being is inversely proportional to human numbers is directly counterfactual. If you look at history, the exact opposite is true. And anyone can see that the advance of human knowledge has improved the human condition.
All right, my guest is Robert Zubin. So, Robert, let's use some real-world examples to bring this home for our listeners. And let's start out here in the West. We both live in the West, and we're all being plagued by the Western wildfires, particularly in your state. So you assert that the greatest deforestation on Earth is the U.S. West right now. What's the cause of this deforestation, and how does it tie into your theory?
Well, okay, over the past 10 years, between the American West and the Canadian West, we've lost 60 million acres of trees to the western pine beetle. That's 6 million acres a year, which is twice the rate of deforestation of the Amazon, which is 3 million a year. Now, the environmentalists make a big deal about the deforestation of the Amazon because it's being done by lumbering interests, but the much bigger deforestation going on here, they could care less about, because it's being done by beetles. In fact, they've launched over 1,000 lawsuits to stop any efforts of rational forest management through logging that would stop the spread of the beetles. The beetles are spreading radically because they have these extremely thick forests of mature trees that are ideal for the beetles, and they're all connected to each other. When the Forest Service or others says, we have a plan, we're going to thin them out, they launch lawsuits to stop it. When they want to log gaps between forests that would create quarantine zones, they launch lawsuits to stop it. When they want to log out the already dead trees that are sitting there as ammunition that is waiting to go up in smoke at the merest spark, or the literally whole counties filled with dry, dead timber, and they want to log this stuff out, and it is good wood, by the way, they launch lawsuits to stop it. Over 1,000 lawsuits. They've cost us over $4 billion, by the way, the taxpayers, because they charge lawyers' fees, and the federal government accommodates them by paying their lawyer fees. They pay the environmentalist lawyers $500 an hour to sue us to stop us from saving our forests. So the result is that millions of acres of forest are going to go up in flame. Millions of animals are going to be burnt alive. Hundreds of houses are going to be destroyed. Firefighters are going to be killed. Okay, and massive amounts of pollution is going to be added to the atmosphere because of these so-called environmentalists who are not protectors of nature. They are simply enemies of mankind.
All right, my guest is Robert Zubin. So, Robert, you've laid out the problem very eloquently. So what can humanists do to combat anti-humanists?
Well, first of all, what we have to do is expose this ideology for what it is, because it takes many forms, and I discuss many of them in the book. If this thing has mutated and has attempted to appeal to different groups of people, ranging from the left to the right, from everything from feminists to militarists, they've attempted to make their pitch, but it's always the same thing in a different disguise. And so we have to expose it. Secondly, we have to stop funding it. We have to stop funding these environmentalist organizations with taxpayer dollars. We have to stop funding the population control organizations with taxpayers' dollars. You know, this year, the United States taxpayers are going to pay $600 million that is going to be outsourced through population control organizations like Planned Parenthood, the Population Council, to administer forced sterilization programs in third world countries that these countries don't want, but which is being imposed on them as a condition for receiving U.S. foreign aid. This makes enemies for America around the world, and it's costing us $600 million a year in order to commit crimes against humanity. We should simply insist that this not be funded. We have to stop funding the Environmental Protection Agency, okay, which is wrecking our economy. You know, the United States invented the oil industry in 1859, and we were the world's leader in oil for over a century. During World War II, we produced half again as much oil as the entire rest of the world put together. But our oil production peaked in 1971, which is exactly this year that the Environmental Protection Agency goes into operation, making more drilling impossible or nearly impossible or much more expensive than it needs to be. And we've been declining ever since, so now we produce 7% of the world's oil instead of 65% of the percent of the world's oil. And as a result, we're at the mercy of OPEC, which has rigged up oil prices and is looting our economy, and is in fact the cause of the current recession, and causing even worse consequences in poorer countries, which can afford expensive oil much less than we can.
And we're going to have to leave it there. My guest has been Robert Zubrin, author of the book Merchants of Despair. Robert, if people are intrigued by what you have to say and they want to learn more about you, learn more about the book, where would you direct them to go on the Internet?
Well, there's a website, merchantsofdespair.com.
MerchantsofDespair.com. Robert, it has been a delight. Thank you so much for being my special guest here on The Bill Frank Show. We'll talk to you down the road.
All right. Glad to do it again.